Welcome to Open Spaces. For Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadalska. Wyoming lawmakers heard from agency heads about their budget requests this month. There has been a little friction.
I'm going to make sure that this is done, and that's going to include possible litigation against the governor's office.
The top market for coal is burning it for electricity, but researchers are trying to find alternative uses, like farming.
And like, do the yield, I guess the crop yield that comes out, does it have like a coal film on it?
No. No.
But it's worries like that could hold alternative coal back. What does it take to rebrand a word like coal? And in a time when the United States government is not celebrating diversity, one town in Wyoming is honoring its diverse roots.
When it was a coal mining town, there were 56 nationalities that sort of developed Rock Springs and called it home.
All of that and more coming up on Open Spaces.
Want to keep up with local news but can't have your radio on 24/7? That's where Wyoming Public Radio's email newsletters come in. Get all of the local and regional news you want in your inbox. You can choose if you want an update every day or a weekly roundup of our top stories, or both. Sign up on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadalska. Earlier this month, Hoskinson Contracting and Hoskinson Concrete sent reduction in force letters to 136 employees in Gillette. The governor's office called it one of the most significant layoffs Wyoming has ever seen and raised alarm bells about the state losing skilled construction and trade workers. Charles Hoskinson co-founded the companies, along with the up-and-coming Hoskinson Health and Wellness Clinic, which is looking at an expansion in the next few years called Phase 3. He spoke with Wyoming Public Radio's Nikki Woulette about the role he sees his companies playing in Gillette and the state.
What was your vision when you formed Hoskinson Contracting and Hoskinson Concrete back in 2022? Were these meant to be forever companies, or were they just formed to help build the Hoskinson Health and Wellness Clinic?
Yeah, you know, it's kind of an accidental company. So what happened was we wanted to build a massive medical facility in Gillette, Wyoming, that would become kind of a regional hub like Mayo Clinic is to Rochester. And the challenge is that in Campbell County, no one's ever really built anything quite like this. It's not a small town, but it's not a big town. And so it's not really set up for a massive medical facility with, you know, tier one surgeons and cancer treatments and medical research and all these types of things. So when we started building it, we used local contractors. And the first phase was over budget. It took an extra 9 months. The quality really wasn't there. So we were deeply frustrated. And we said, you know, it would be really cool if we just kind of built a companion construction company to help facilitate the construction of the clinic. So we set up the contracting company and we started scaling and expanding it. And we really grew it because the next phase of the clinic went from 10,000 square feet to about 60,000 square feet. And then what we were doing is trying to make a strategic decision. Did it make sense to stay in the construction business? Because taking custody of that medical facility is going to take 1 to 2 years. What did the construction company do in the meantime while we're waiting for the next major phase? So we looked at some local contracts and bids, and they came at various sizes, but we really couldn't find anything to justify, you know, a $20 million payroll and, you know, hundreds of people floating around. So we said, what makes sense is to change the model a little bit. So let's preserve the really good locals, the master electricians, the plumbers, the architects, the project managers, which is about 43 people. And then let go of people, starting with people who were start out of state, like the Californians that came over and the Floridians and the Texans and these things. And then some of the divisions that came from South Dakota, like concrete, for example, let's let those guys go and give them a 60-day severance and try to work and see who can go to other places, either in my other companies or throughout the state. It's a natural thing about construction. There's ebbs and flows.
This doesn't apply to many companies in Wyoming because we're so small, but federal law requires most employers to give a 60-day heads up to workers and state and local representatives if their company employs more than 100 people and they're planning mass layoffs. Did you file a WARN notice?
Yes, we did. That's why the governor knew and commented on it.
I asked the governor's office to share a copy, and the Department of Workforce Services sent it over. It says the Hoskinsons have decided to focus their energies on the clinic and don't plan to do any construction. It says your last day of employment will be January 31st and set a follow-up meeting for information about separation, benefits, and final compensation. I asked Hoskinson for details about the severance he mentioned and what other support he's offering his workers.
We're following all the requisite laws, and 60 days severance is the salary, and all the requisite benefit tails and these other things are being followed. What we tried to do is see if we could relocate people to other business divisions if they had these skills, and that's why we were able to hold on to more than 40. We also gave referrals to other construction companies where and when that made sense.
In the past couple of years, you've created a pretty large presence in Gillette, so I've got two questions. How do you see these layoffs affecting the local community? And then are you planning to continue that presence? Like, why are you putting roots down here in Gillette?
It's kind of a funny thing. We've put $200 million into Gillette. We built the largest medical center in the entire state that's family-owned and operated. We take care of 18,000 people, and that center continues to grow, and it's a center of excellence for not only patient care, but also medical research. It's the only center in the entire state that has a mandate and focus to do clinical trials for stem cells and actually heal our wounded warriors and heal burn victims and treat people post-cancers who have been damaged by chemotherapy, regrow limbs, you know, all the kinds of sci-fi stuff that we've been promised for 30 years is going to come, but never seems to come. We're actually doing that stuff. My parents live in Gillette. I have a residence in Gillette. My brother lives in Gillette. We have very strong roots there, and they've been physicians there for nearly 10 years, and they've taken care of thousands of people. We deeply care about this community, and I wouldn't have invested hundreds of millions of dollars, and I wouldn't have brought some of the most talented people in the world there. These are the jobs that Gillette needs when we look to the future in the next 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. We need new industries like biotechnology. We need a revolution in medical education and medical practice. And I really do believe the clinic can become one of the economic backbones. It still is and continues to grow, is one of the largest employers in the town. And I have a belief that over time, it will become the largest employer in the town. You know, the construction company was a means to an end, meaning it was there to build this facility.
You've talked a little bit about phase three.
So phase three is going to add surgery and cancer, and it's probably going to be well over 100,000 additional square feet. So we're probably not going to begin construction on that until optimistically early 2027, pessimistically the end of 2027. Now, in parallel, we're also talking about biotechnology, and there's stem cell manufacturing, stem cell harvesting. Some of that's in Gillette. Some of that's with partner organizations like the University of Wyoming. We've already given $2.2 million to the University of Wyoming. We're developing devices to extract stem cells much more easily for older people because it's very invasive right now when you extract adipose-derived stem cells, and I just want to make it like a patch.
Do you see your construction company scaling back up to meet those needs when you start building again in 2027?
No, I think the issue is we're going to do owner rep now. I think for what we do, it's a better model. Because really, when you think about construction, there's three things you care about: time to completion, the quality of completion, and the cost. Those are your three big things. And so you bring a GC in, and now you have a firm to attach to the GC that acts as your quality control gate and your timekeeper, and also it acts as the purse keeper. So they regulate the money flow. So you write a contract with the GC where our people work alongside with the GC, and they inspect the work in stages, and they make sure everything's in Procore and everything's done right. And then we release money in tranches after the fit and finish is to our satisfaction. There's a lot of institutional knowledge that we've built up over the last 2 years that where we know what good looks like. And that's really the value of what's happened over the last 2 years.
Charles Hoskinson, thanks so much for talking with us about your business interests and vision for Gillette.
Thank you so much, Nikki.
The Hoskinson Health and Wellness Clinic charges a flat fee of $250 per month and has no copays for patients without traditional insurance. That price is comparatively low, as subsidies that help lower the cost of health insurance on the Affordable Care Act's marketplace are set to expire at the end of this year. Some people may see a monthly cost increase of up to 200%. Two proposals, one from Republicans and one from Democrats, that could have offered solutions were just blocked. Wyoming's congressional delegation opposed a Democrats' extension proposal and supported the GOP's replacement. With the holiday break around the corner, it's unclear if Congress will come up with a solution before the more expensive premiums go into effect at the start of the new year. Jackson Hole Community Radio's Jenna McMurtry reports Wyoming is set to face some of the highest price hikes in the country.
Sadie Frank first moved to Jackson in 2020. By 2021, she landed a job at a local arts organization.
I'm one of three full-time people running a theater company.
Like many small nonprofits and businesses in town, OffSquare can't afford to provide reasonable health insurance for its employees.
We've had lots of different discussions about what's possible, but it just hasn't been feasible for us.
In the meantime, without some sort of subsidy, most marketplace plans could soon be out of reach for working-class Wyomingites altogether. People like Frank have to pick a plan by January to avoid a lapse in coverage.
So I have to just look at my eligibility notice. I am eligible to enroll in a 2026 marketplace plan.
With weeks to go, she's not yet sure what next year's coverage options look like. She pulls out her laptop and logs onto the application.
I'm just gonna send good vibes to healthcare.gov.
She braces to see the new cost of her monthly premium. She already feels stretched thin.
My monthly premium this year that I'm currently still paying is out of pocket is $348.
And does that feel like that's reasonable for you, or is that a little bit of a financial burden? Like, how do you feel right now what you're paying?
It feels deeply unreasonable, Jenna. It's a huge monthly expense, and I love my job, and I think that I'm paid well, but this is an expensive place to live, and it doesn't help.
And this year's new cost won't make living in Jackson any easier.
It says I can have a monthly premium as low as $676 in the bronze category.
That's the cheapest plan. Gold and silver are even more expensive.
Not quite doubled.
Wow. How does that feel? Because you were just saying that's already a lot of money for you.
Mm-hmm. What a fool to be cautiously optimistic.
And this year, she only has one coverage option. Her previous provider, Mountain Health Co-op, will leave Wyoming at the end of the year, making Blue Cross Blue Shield the only marketplace option for Teton County residents. The 28-year-old says she plans to take on more side gigs like bartending, but a longtime healthcare practitioner worries that not everyone has that option.
The Affordable Care Act has been a huge boon for my patients.
Doctors like Bruce Hayes fear that no subsidy means more Jackson residents may opt to forego health insurance altogether.
Everybody else has said things like my premiums are going to double, triple, quadruple. They're going to become $2,000, $3,000 a month. I can't afford that, obviously.
Donning his everyday cowboy boots and a horseshoe mustache, the practitioner of over four decades says he's concerned about what the new cost means for his primary patients. He's crunched the numbers. About a quarter of his patients face this new reality on the marketplace.
And especially here in Jackson, where we have a lot of people doing a lot of outdoor activities, there's always a certain amount of risk of trauma, and trauma is a very expensive thing to fix.
Hayes says patients might seek less care as a result. While his private practice should be okay, he also sits on the board of St. John's Health, where he says finances are more precarious. From property tax cuts, a loss in federal funding, and high rates of uncompensated care, he says community hospitals are struggling to stay open.
Having a small rural hospital is not a very financially viable endeavor.
Hayes isn't sure that there's an option that sits well with him. When patients ask what to do, he doesn't have a good answer.
Can't say, you should just buck up and spend 50% of your income on insurance and the other 50% on housing and, you know, you'll be fine. Go get food from the food bank. It's not a nice thing to be able to say to people.
If Wyomingites want to see change, Hayes says it's going to take pressure on those in power. For K12 News, I'm Jenna McMurtry.
Wyoming wants coal to stay king, and it's looking for other ways to use it besides energy production. We'll hear some promising ideas next on Open Spaces.
It can be hard to keep track of the news, but Wyoming Public Radio just made it a little easier.
Now you can follow us on Apple News to get the latest stories from Wyoming right in the palm of your hand. Plus, you can get an audio roundup of daily local news in under 10 minutes with our new podcast. Check out Wyoming Debrief, a morning habit that pairs perfectly with your cup of coffee.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. When a product becomes really known for a particular thing, it can be hard to envision it for anything else. Take baking soda. For years, it was literally for baking, like a half teaspoon in your cookies. But later, it was marketed as a way to freshen up a stinky fridge or stained carpet. And that requires a full box. Sales increase dramatically. Now, a research lab at the University of Wyoming is trying to do something similar for coal. The idea is to keep Wyoming mines open longer. The state is home to the nation's largest supply. Wyoming Public Radio's Caitlin Tan reports.
I'm in a University of Wyoming building that houses much of the state's coal research. And before me are tables with construction materials.
Okay, so I'm picking up the commercial clay brick, heavy.
And next to the regular bricks are ones made with coal.
Wow, yeah. Really light.
Yeah, really light. So,
but is that good?
No, that's really good.
It's okay.
That's really good because it's compressive strength.
That's Trina Eigelsrud Pfeiffer. Wyoming brought her on in 2017 to help find new uses for coal. Demand from power plants has halved over the last 15 years.
It was Wyoming's economic need to make sure that coal stayed relevant and viable, and that the coal towns actually kept people employed and, you know, businesses running and things like that.
Eigelsrud Pfeiffer says her team's research proves it can be used for construction materials, like the bricks, or road paving, or even a soil additive for crop fields.
And like, do the yield, I guess the crop yield that comes out, does it have like a coal film on it?
No. Oh, no.
So the crops don't come out black like coal, but it's worries like that that are tricky to overcome. Eigelsrud Pfeiffer says that for a long time,
we didn't even use the word coal. We said carbon ore. Because of the CO2 issues and things like that, it was the bad actor, if you will.
Burning coal releases emissions that are harmful to our health and the environment. But Eigelsrud Pfeiffer says that's not the case for the alternative uses she's researching. And getting that point across to the public can take a lot of clever marketing. It's called repositioning, something Boston University professor Susan Jung Grant studies closely.
You have to start with the associations that people have, whether they are positive, negative, or neutral.
Jung Grant says repositioning usually happens when interest in a product is waning. Take Old Spice. 1970s commercials show weathered-looking sailors and farmers lathering up with the brand's products, shaving soap and aftershave.
Come on, wake up to the freshness of the open sea with Old Spice.
Jung Grant says it was viewed as old, something for
your dad or your grandfather, and it had a very stodgy image.
Look down, back up, where are you?
You're on a boat.
But newer ads show a shirtless, fit man sitting on a white horse on the beach.
Anything is possible when your man smells like Old Spice and not a lady. I'm on a horse.
Old Spice is now a deodorant, shampoo, body spray, and it's used by younger brothers, boyfriends, teenagers.
It's become redefined, and it has a lot of humor in the way it's introduced.
So that's repositioning, which is what coal is up against. University of Wyoming economics professor Rob Godby says also,
what we really want is a lot of volume.
Coal kind of has that baking soda quantity problem.
So the idea would be, what if we could find a product you could use coal for that has a large market, right?
In theory, the construction industry could become for coal what a stinky fridge is for baking soda. But Godby says those products will use a lot less coal compared to electricity. Although this year, that demand is the second lowest it's ever been. Some power plants in the state are already shifting away from coal.
That's the real problem. The decline in coal is happening faster than alternative uses of coal are being developed.
Eigelsrud Pfeiffer's team is racing to soften the blow. Their vision is coal brick houses, coal highways, coal soil amendments. But to complete that research, they're asking Wyoming lawmakers to set aside $2 million in the state budget. They'll find out in the spring. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Caitlin Tan.
When you think about how the state of Wyoming spends its money, where it all goes, and why it goes where it goes, things can feel pretty abstract. Those cash questions got real this month when state lawmakers on the Joint Appropriations Committee, or JAC, started holding public hearings on the governor's proposed budget. And the budget is a big deal. It's a blueprint for state spending over the next 2 years, but it's also a barometer of which parts of government lawmakers care about and which they'll kick down the road. The fates of thousands of state employees, scores of agencies, and grants to local projects hang in the balance. So with me today to talk about the first 2 weeks of the budget hearings are Wyoming Public Radio's state government reporters, Jordan Uplinger and Chris Clements.
Hello.
Hey, guys.
All right. So how does this budget hearing process work?
Yes. So the governor sets the stage first, as they say. Every other year, he or she releases a budget proposal that was crafted with input from agency leaders, attorneys, and other top dogs.
Right. The governor can either recommend agencies and programs be funded at the level their leadership asked for, below the level they asked for, or above what they asked for. Since this upcoming legislative session is a budget session, funding decisions made this year will carry over to the next 2 years.
And after the governor does his thing, lawmakers on the JAC hold hearings at the Capitol. Agency heads make their funding pitches directly to lawmakers, and it might sound like a real snooze fest, but these discussions really reveal the health of the state's bank accounts, where government is and isn't living up to its promises to Wyomingites, and what its long-term goals are.
Lawmakers will continue this process for one more week in January, and then they'll start making up the budget as they see fit. And then it's introduced in the House and Senate for the budget session in February.
Okay, so that's the nuts and bolts. So who's on this committee?
There are 12 members, 7 from the House and 5 from the Senate. The Wyoming Freedom Caucus has a majority on the committee between members and endorsees. That means the further right caucus may have some leeway to determine how the first steps of this process shake out.
So, moving on to the highlights of the last 2 weeks, let's take it day by day. Fill me in on what you've been watching and why, and what stuck out.
Yeah, things got peppery on day one, Camila, when Secretary of State Chuck Gray presented his office's requests. Gray testified that Governor Mark Gordon failed to adequately fund his office when he denied a $125,000 expenditure. That money was meant to advertise the 50% property tax reduction ballot initiative that will be on the 2026 ballot.
I'm going to make sure that this is done, and that's going to include possible litigation against the governor's office if we don't have the process in place for us to do this, because this is statutorily required.
Gordon's spokesperson said if Gray wanted more money, he should ask the JAC.
Okay, so a dust-up between a moderate and a founding member of the caucus. What else?
Well, a few days later, the Wyoming Business Council went before the JAC. Council CEO Josh Durrell faced scrutiny from Freedom Caucus lawmakers and senators like Tim Salazar of Riverton, who sounded skeptical of the state's Economic Development Agency.
The document that you gave us here, yes, that we've all gone through, you know, slide after slide, we are in a long-term decline, jobs are stagnant, wages are shrinking, worst migration rate in this country. I guess my question is, help me understand what the Wyoming Business Council has done over the years.
Durrell said the council has been trying to figure out how to better serve the state, and that doing so might require more investment. He said it'll be harder to do that if lawmakers go with the governor's recommendation, which was half of what the council asked for.
Wow. And what about the health department's request? They're the largest agency in the state. How did they fare?
So over the fall, Freedom Caucus member Representative Ken Pendergraft of Sheridan was trying to figure out how to find cuts in the state health department's budget as part of a subcommittee under the JAC. Lawmakers have compared that panel's goals to those of DOGE. Here's a colloquy between Pendergraft and the agency director, Stefan Johansson, that I thought exemplified the dynamic between them fairly well.
Thank you, Director, for being here. Seems like we've almost become family.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pendergraft, thank you. And yes, it does feel like we've become family. And as the old saying goes, you can choose your friends, but not your family. And I bet that's felt both ways.
Fascinating. Jordan, what about you?
Broadly speaking, I've noticed a theme common across agencies and departments. Obviously, everyone wants a qualified worker for the job. But directors and administrators kept adding this caveat. Even if we get the qualified worker, it's hard to retain them. There's a few examples. The director of the Office of Consumer Advocate, Anthony Ornelas, said he lost two attorneys in less than 24 months. One left due to the challenges of the role, and the other...
The other one was recruited by a competing out-of-state law firm who works in utility litigation. We are constantly competing with a variety of outside firms to retain this talent.
That difficulty in retaining an attorney kind of starts to make sense when you hear Erin Williams with the Department of Administration and Information. Here she is talking about the state's pay tables compared to the market average.
Our nursing pay table numbers are still 21.2% behind. Similar numbers for our attorney pay scale were 17.9% behind.
And then there's State Forester Kelly Norris comparing wildfire fighter benefits to benefits here in nearby states.
For hazard pay, Idaho, Montana, Nevada, New Mexico, Utah, Alaska, Arizona, they all have hazard pay. We don't do hazard pay.
Yeah, and I'll note that Gordon and the University of Wyoming president also both said their priority was increasing employee wages. And since I just mentioned UW, what are they asking for?
Well, the university asked for more than $2 million for a coal research project that's looking for non-energy uses for Wyoming coal. That $2 million would go towards a project that's already underway in Gillette. UW also asked for more money for athletics, research, and education.
Got it. And staying in education, what were the Department of Education's asks?
This one's a little more difficult to nail down. That's because there's an elephant in the room. The ongoing recalibration process. Lawmakers will draft a separate bill this upcoming session, reworking how Wyoming funds its public schools. The specifics of that individual bill will impact how funding is calculated in the state budget bill overall. So this means adjustments will be made to the department's budget up to and into the legislative session in February.
A lot to take in, and they're really just getting started.
Right. The JAC will hear from more agencies next month and then start altering the budget as they see fit.
Yeah, and before we go, I thought it was interesting. Members of the Freedom Caucus have twice now worn these red blazers. They say it's to raise awareness that the state is heading into the red fiscally, and they'd like to bring spending back to pre-COVID levels. More moderate lawmakers, though, they caution that cutting to the bone would bring about a budget crisis. It's a narrative and debate among lawmakers we're sure to see and hear more of in the upcoming budget session.
Well, we're looking forward to your future reporting. Thanks, you two.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks.
Coming up on Open Spaces, we explore how agreements between local law enforcement agencies and ICE have skyrocketed in our region since Donald Trump became president again.
This time on the Modern West. We meet a couple who won a tiny house in an auction. It was a real nail-biter.
Every day we check it, and then, like, still we're winning. And then the night before the thing closed, someone bid for, like, $45,000.
Yeah.
And we were like, what? Like, that's such a huge jump.
The Teeny Tiny House. It's episode 4 of Cheap Dirt. Find it under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Sponsored by Omnivest Financial.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kadalska. One key tool in ramped up immigration enforcement efforts is close collaboration with local agencies. It often hinges on agreements with ICE called 287Gs. In Wyoming, the National Guard, Highway Patrol, and 5 counties have signed on to such agreements. In the region, 287Gs have risen fivefold since January, when President Trump was sworn in, as the Mountain West News Bureau's Yvette Fernandez reports.
The Grito Ceremony is a historical reenactment commemorating Mexico's independence from Spain. This Fiestas Patrias, or Patriotic Festival, is taking place in Las Vegas, as it does every September.
People are very enthusiastic about them and are always very happy to celebrate their Mexican origin.
That's Patricia Cortez with the Regional Mexican Consulate.
And what that means to the community.
But elsewhere, events like these have been canceled, organizers citing fears over federal crackdowns on immigration. But increasingly, immigrants are also wary of local law enforcement agencies that have signed 287G agreements with ICE, like the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department. Sanmita Ramich with the American Civil Liberties Union of Nevada explains it this way.
The 287G agreement is a contract between the federal government and a local entity stating that this local entity will engage in a certain level of immigration enforcement.
A Mountain West News Bureau analysis found Nevada and other agencies in our region, Arizona, Idaho, New Mexico, Utah, and Wyoming, saw significant increases in 287G agreements since President Trump was inaugurated in January. The number surged from 10 agreements in Mountain West states to 54 today, following a trend across the country. Only Colorado bucked that trend. There, state law preventing collaboration with federal officials has stymied 287G agreements and even led to a court battle involving one county sheriff. Some of the agreements train local officers to act as federal deputized agents. Others bring local departments into task forces. And some 287Gs, including the one in Las Vegas, involve ICE holes in jails. Here, the ACLU has filed a lawsuit alleging that the department wrongfully detained Sergio Morales Echevarria, a Cuban immigrant accused of auto theft. The ACLU says local authorities defied a court order.
Nevada District Court judge ordered him to be transported to inpatient treatment.
Instead, he was released into ICE custody.
And what's really interesting about this portion is that this ICE hold, this doesn't come from any judge. It's not coming from a federal judge. It's not coming from any judiciary whatsoever. It's just coming from an ICE official.
The ACLU says Morales Echevarria was denied due process. Days before the case was to be heard in court, the sheriff was at a joint press conference with the FBI. We asked the sheriff about the ACLU case.
I will tell you that the individual that they are suing us over is no longer in custody of the Clark County Detention Center.
The sheriff did not offer any more specifics.
The ICE is picking up people from the Clark County Detention Center today on a daily basis.
He added that the department's agreement with ICE is focused on immigrants in the jail accused of serious felonies and other crimes.
If they're foreign-born and they're arrested for one of those offenses into my jail, we make an ICE notification. Subsequent to an individual being released from the jail, we also make an ICE notification, and a judicial warrant can be served by ICE to hold an individual for up to 48 hours.
In a subsequent statement to us, Metro reiterated that officers do not enforce immigration violations. The Nevada ACLU lawsuit also argues that the department should not be allowed to participate in 287G.
In Nevada, we have a law that prohibits civil arrests, which in this case, these are civil immigration detainees.
That's why the ACLU has taken up the Morales Echevarria case.
And the court would like to begin with a threshold question of standing.
Alex Fugazi, the attorney representing the Las Vegas police, in November told the court that the department's 287G agreement was not in effect when Morales Echevarria was detained. He said while it was signed in June and Morales Echevarria was detained in August, the program was not yet officially credentialed.
What I'm telling you today, Your Honor, is that the credentials have not been given to a Metropolitan Police officer yet.
So Fugazi said the man was detained under other policies.
Qualified foreign-born individuals who were arrested and charged.
The ACLU accused Fugazi of using legal tactics, splitting hairs.
And then are using that to argue that the court should not get to this point.
In a case that could touch on several laws that govern immigrants in the criminal justice system. Ramich told the judge there's a greater issue at stake.
This is about the liberty interests of hundreds of people that will be held pursuant to this agreement.
The ACLU said it has tracked hundreds of local ICE holes. The police department declined to confirm any numbers for us. Meanwhile, experts like University of Las Vegas immigration professor Michael Kagan are concerned about the fast proliferation of 287G agreements.
Almost all immigration enforcement is just not a criminal matter. It is a civil administrative matter. That is just a fact about American immigration law.
He does not think the feds should tie up local resources.
ICE loves to get local governments to basically lend their resources to the federal government to do the federal government's job. And that's really what the 287G program is. That is a force multiplier, often at the cost to local taxpayers.
President Trump has been very aggressive.
But Secretary of Homeland Security Kristi Noem, who oversees ICE, said during a recent visit to Las Vegas that local help is exactly what the federal government wants, and there are local officers that want to cooperate.
I think so many law enforcement officers across the country are just grateful that they finally get to do their jobs. But we'll continue to do our job and make sure that we're enforcing our law.
We asked if there would be raids in Las Vegas.
Can't speak directly to law enforcement operations that are planned because it jeopardizes the safety of those law enforcement officers. But we will be here. We will continue to be here. It will be sustained, and at times it will surge based on the threats that we see.
As many fear attending cultural events because of stepped-up enforcement, some consulates across the U.S., like the Mexican consulate in Las Vegas, are providing information at detention centers about consular notifications.
To let us know that they're there and so that we can help them in the situation that they are in.
As for Sergio Morales Echevarria, he could not be reached for this story. The ACLU says he was deported to Mexico. Yet the court battle emanating from his situation continues. It is expected to resume in January. Meanwhile, the Trump administration has appropriated $75 billion to arrest and deport, quote, unauthorized immigrants. Some funds will also go toward hiring 10,000 more officers and to fund more federal detention facilities. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Yvette Fernandez.
In a conservative county that has backed federal immigration enforcement efforts for years, one Wyoming city is promoting its Latino businesses. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Merzbach takes us to a recently rebranded Hispanic district in Rock Springs.
First, a big layer of mayonnaise goes into a styrofoam cup. Then a generous sprinkling of cheese and a scoop of juicy corn from a silver pot. Top it with lime, salt, and chili, and you've got a cup of Leti Franco Espericueta's famous elote.
This looks delicious.
Enjoy.
We're inside Espericueta's shop on the edge of downtown Rock Springs. It's called Antojitos Mi Pueblito and sells snacks from her hometown, from ceviche to ice cream. Espericueta's a mom with four girls.
Me interesó porque...
Her oldest, Jocelyn Franco Campo, summarizes in English.
She decided her inspiration was from where she grew up in Mexico.
In the coastal state of Nayarit.
I guess it just reminds her a lot of her childhood, and it was like something that brought her closer to where she was from.
This is one of several Latino-owned businesses clustered on part of the block, which the city recently rebranded as the Las Americas Hispanic District. Go outside and pastel orange and yellow buildings line the narrow street with a Mexican restaurant, market, and a jewelry, leather, and piñata shop. It's also a place in transition with closed-up storefronts and a lively gentleman's club.
And so we identified this block as having the most challenges, the most potential, but a lot of assets.
Chad Banks leads the city's urban renewal agency.
Particularly the Latino entrepreneurs kind of taking ownership of this block.
Rock Springs, a boom and bust coal town, is trying to rebrand not just the block, but all parts of its city center. That's thanks to grant funding from the State Business Council and national organization Main Street America, which helps revitalize downtowns and invite in all residents. That includes almost 90 places in the Mountain West, 8 of them in Wyoming.
That's where entertainment happens. This is where community gatherings happen. This is where parades happen.
Touring around the block, Banks says the city's trying to get more people of all backgrounds to open up shop. He points to new benches, murals, and a newly paved parking lot, which used to house a Chinese market. Banks says Rock Springs prides itself as the home of dozens of nationalities.
When it was a coal mining town, there were 56 nationalities that sort of developed Rock Springs and called it home.
The name Las Americas Hispanic District tries to honor those diverse roots, while recognizing what the neighborhood is now. About 17% of the city's residents are Hispanic, one of the largest communities in the state. Here's Espericueta and her daughter Jocelyn again.
We've had to say at least 10 goodbyes to 10 different families because they've decided to leave town.
Local law enforcement here has been working closely with ICE since 2020, and this year signed two new agreements with the federal agency. sitting on the porch outside her shop, Esperiqueta says this has slowed business. And putting a sign up saying Hispanic district could bring unwanted attention.
It does put us at risk. It hasn't yet, but it is a worry.
But at the same time, Esperiqueta says as an immigrant, she feels safe and supported here, especially with the community's investments on the block.
Rock Springs, siempre lo he dicho, es una comunidad que siempre la bienvenida a todos.
Rock Springs, she's always loved it. She's loved Wyoming. And contrary to what anyone else says, she's loved it because they've always welcomed her with open arms.
And with snacks like elote and ceviche, Esperiqueta hopes to help others feel right at home. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Hannah Merzbach in Rock Springs.
Up next on Open Spaces, we learn about the Eastern Shoshone Tribe's proposals for a new cultural hub. Stay with us.
Hearing one story over and over again gets pretty old pretty fast. On Morning Edition, you'll hear all kinds of stories, from the big news to things that are just fun. Listen to Morning Edition every weekday from NPR News.
From 5 until 9 on Wyoming Public Radio.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. The Eastern Shoshone Tribe is working on a new centralized cultural hub and museum. Community members have carried the vision forward for decades, but the tribe recently got a big boost from a rural design program. The new space isn't built yet. It's slated for the lot across from the gas station in Fort Washakie. The plan is to put four tribal departments under one roof: archives, cultural arts and education, tribal historic preservation, and enrollment. The idea is also to increase tourism and pass information down to younger generations. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman stopped by an event at the Fort Washakie School to hear how the project's been progressing.
From above, the building might look like a Shoshone rose to symbolize a place of healing for the community. On the inside, the details are still on the table.
These are really minimalist, very simple, lightweight. These are much kind of bulkier, massive. You like this one.
Architect Omar Hakim gestures next to a semicircle of poster boards. They've got pictures of different interior spaces, lighter, darker, with exposed wood panels or steel beams.
We're talking about the kinds of spaces, like what does a classroom in a building like this look like, feel like? What types of furniture or materials and textures should it have?
There's a couple interactive stations set up around the school gym. The open house event is all about getting input on the ongoing cultural hub project. The new building would bring four tribal departments together and create a space to celebrate and preserve Shoshone culture. At Hakim Station, people use colored stickers to show what design elements resonate most with them.
So, can I put a sticker up here then?
Darker one.
He says the building needs to be functional and reflective of the community.
We have to make sure a building is technically appropriate as a repository and archive and holding place for such sensitive histories, and is culturally appropriate. Both of those have to work together.
That means a state-of-the-art, climate-controlled space to digitize archives, share pieces of history, and prevent artifacts from degrading. The current facility doesn't totally cut it, and sometimes the tribe has to turn away items that belong to the people.
Right now, the tribe cannot hold them. They cannot carry them. They do not have the facilities and the resources at this time to do that.
At another station, folks put felt flowers, circles, and tags on a map of the space to show what they'd like the outside of the building to look like.
One of the ideas I wrote down is an observatory for lunar, solar equinoxes, and celestial alignments.
Cass Burson is a member of the Eastern Shoshone Tribe. There's also a mini powwow space on the map and community gardens.
I just think that a lot of community has already started to fill out the tags and include their ideas and their thoughts, and I think that's great.
Rachel Yenostrosa says she really liked seeing a 3D model of the building.
I think it's going to be a reality. We're going to have this, but it's not going to be like tomorrow. It'll be in a few years.
She's the new interim director at the tribe's cultural center, which will eventually move to the new hub. Yenostrosa spent a lot of time in the food world and is extra excited about the idea of a cafe.
Do we want buffalo meat? Do we want trout? How do we want it? Do we want a fast food? Do we want to-go boxes? You know, or we want a dine-in?
Robin Rothkar is hanging out at the last station, where people, mostly kids, draw what they want to see at the museum.
I really like this one. So we want to keep them. So put them here.
She's worked at the Cultural Center for 5 years, but now she's the director for the Hub Project.
I'm really excited just to have a place where our people, especially our elders, can go and hang out, talk to each other, have a cup of coffee.
Funding is the biggest hurdle. The project's raised almost $1 million in grants so far, and it'll take millions more to fund the actual construction. That could be especially difficult with the Trump administration canceling several grants the project had planned to apply for. But Rothkar says the community has momentum.
There's been many pushes towards that in the past that haven't come to fruition. I don't want it to fail on my watch at all.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Hannah Haberman in Fort Washakie.
Researchers at the University of Wyoming have been studying how well plants thrive outside their preferred ecosystems. They planted 8 gardens in our region at different elevations. If these plants do well, humans could potentially help them migrate so they don't go extinct. Late last summer, Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards visited one garden at 8,600 feet in the mountains west of Laramie.
UW botanist Daniel Laughlin walks out into an unusual garden.
Yeah, I haven't been here in about a month.
So. Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I don't know what to expect.
That's because all around us, black, burnt forest covers the mountainsides, left behind by the Mullen Fire of 2020. He walks down the rows of plants protected inside plastic nets. They're spaced 4 feet apart and in blocks of 10 of each species. The garden was planted in the spring, but he wasn't sure it would still be alive.
We're interested in how trees are going to regenerate and move across the landscape in response to drought and fire in general.
You might be thinking, wait, trees are rooted. They can't move.
These trees have been marching across the continent for the last, 40 to 50 million years, some of them. And they're not doing it as individuals. They're doing it as populations. Their seeds are traveling far distances.
He got curious about this when he studied arboretums across the U.S. and found 188 different species of trees often only grow in about 25% of their actual thermal niche. That means they can grow in a much wider array of climates than where we're used to seeing them. This garden is testing that.
This is a pinyon pine.
Oh, really?
Which doesn't normally grow here. At elevation of 8,600 feet. So this is actually testing its cold tolerance by bringing it up this high.
This study asks, can pinions or other desert plants move up in elevation as the climate warms?
So I would say of the 10 pinion pine we planted, 7 or 8 are still going strong.
But also, can high mountain trees and plants move down?
Here's one we haven't seen yet. Uh-huh. This is bristlecone pine.
Normally, bristlecone pines live at the tops of mountains.
Yeah, let's see. That's 1, 2, 3, 4.
Not good.
Oh, 3 out of 5. 4 out of 6.
He peeks in each net, counting how many seedlings survived this year's dry summer.
So I think we got 80% survival.
Wow, with bristlecone pine.
Ponderosas, subalpine firs, junipers, 10 tree species total, plus dozens of smaller flowers and bushes.
I think they have much broader environmental tolerances than we give them credit for, but we don't know exactly in which direction those tolerances go. Are they more warm tolerant or are they more cold tolerant? Can they be both?
If we figure that out, he says we might be able to help these plants survive.
Well, one of the most controversial management strategies under climate change is this idea called assisted migration, that some species might do better in other places as the climate changes, but they can't disperse there fast enough.
The Medicine Bow Mountain Experimental Garden Array is testing whether humans could speed that movement up by planting species outside their comfort zone. Laughlin is happy with what he's seeing here.
We've surveyed all of these about 3 weeks ago, and it's approximately 90% survival across all of the plants. Yeah.
If it works, he says, we'll need to ask ourselves some hard questions, like whether to help trees migrate to stop the spread of grasslands.
We've seen type conversions from forest to grasslands and shrublands all over the West, and they have attributed that to a lack of recruitment following fire and drought. You know, there's nothing inherently wrong with grasslands and shrublands either. They're pretty probably great wildlife habitat.
But since it's humans that cause these droughts and wildfires, maybe helping forests relocate is the right thing to do.
I think we do need to be more open-minded about what the future landscapes would look like. We have a connection to these historic classic landscapes, and we want to, you know, make a positive change and restore what we lost. We need to be open to the possibility that what our kids and grandkids will be recreating in might have to be quite different than what we were used to.
This autumn, Laughlin and his crew checked in on the gardens. Some trees didn't do so well, like the desert pinyons and the subalpine firs. But the mountain trees like ponderosas, bristlecones, and limber pines, over half survived the move. As long as Laughlin keeps getting funded, he plans to watch these gardens over years. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
Thank you for listening to Open Spaces. The entire show and all the stories you heard here can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. It can also be found wherever you get your podcasts, and we post all our stories on the station's social media platforms, including Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, X, and Blue Sky. A huge thanks to Ivy Engel, our digital producer, and Cody Hume, our social media manager for today's show. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.